Tonight, I'd like to speak about the Dhamma from what we might say is a whole human perspective. And my hope is that as I speak, we can stay as experience near as possible. So this sense of contact with the world in each moment, just the act of seeing and hearing, is present for us. But also when a reflection arises, when I say something that maybe touches something, to let that be also experienced near. It's not just out there, it's the whole living sense of Dhamma. My sense of what the Buddha was teaching throughout the discourses is could be summed up as saying, what is the human experience and how can we be skillful, wise, as we live it out? So the foundation is, what is the human experience? Because otherwise, what do you do? What difference does it make if you don't know, for example, this first noble truth of suffering? If it's not real, if it's not something you can relate to, who cares? It's an idea. But what does even suffering mean if you don't have a sense of the totality of our lives? And a piece that I'll be focusing on as a balance to what I would say is a more modern understanding of the Buddha's teachings is to touch on the relational aspect of being human, not as separate from the sense of individuality, but as really of a whole in the actuality of how we live. So in this moment, for example, as I'm speaking, you can sense contact with the world, in this case, these sounds of this voice, perhaps seeing this form. And you might touch any sense of I am seeing. Don't worry about weird concepts like self. I just mean the lived experience of hearing and seeing right now, and a sense of, oh, that's happening here at this locus. You know what I'm saying? Right? And so perhaps we can begin in what is a foundation of a observed experience, and that is that what you are seeing and what you're experiencing as you hear these words and as you live on this particular day, in this particular moment, is that each other mind in this room doesn't know and can't touch this experience, right? So it's your subjectivity is so intimate, so unique. See what I'm saying? It's really important to really allow ourselves to touch that sense of individuality, of what we perceive as separateness, of the building of the world here, my world. And it's, you know, I see from this angle, you see from that angle. I have my emotional background, you have yours. Wow, different universes. Yeah? So this part, this perspective on Dhamma, this perspective on the human experience, we know. It's familiar. But I'd like to suggest that, like fish swimming in water and not seeing the water, not feeling, not knowing the water, that it just is. Such is the nature of our relational experience as well. So let me see if we can touch that together now. So to start with the obvious, I'm speaking. And there's hearing happening in each of these individual minds. You are hearing these sounds. And because we've all learned the same language, some meaning arises in the mind. So what's happening now is already a relational experience, very obvious, human to human. But what if you're standing in front of a tree or a rock? Does that partake of this richness of being a biologically relational being? Let me share this reflection with you. Each moment of contact, like this moment, I mean right here, this is not theory, each moment of contact, can you sense that you also carry to this your life history? In other words, you feel like you. You know, you can remember your past, for example. You have a certain feeling tone about life. You feel safe or unsafe. You feel alert and alive in this moment, or pulled back. Everything is conditioned by what came before. So as you see me, as you hear me, all of the people that you've seen, all of perhaps the men you've seen or the teachers you've seen, if we want to get to categories, are impacting how you receive this moment. If you're standing in front of a stone or a tree, not a human being, is that any different? Do you bring to that moment your sense of safety? Do you bring to that moment your sense of history? How could it be otherwise, is what I would say. Each moment conditioned by prior moments. Straight ahead, Buddha Dhamma, but let's just say it's a factor of the being human, that we're so deeply conditioned. And each moment of human contact conditions not only our next moment of human contact, but every moment of our lives. So what this means is that we experience the totality of our lives in the bed, in the matrix of all of our relationships. Every instant of seeing, conditioned. Every instant of hearing, conditioned. Human beings, we evolved to survive. That's sort of how it works, right? That's how evolution works. How did we survive in the face of all these strong, fast, big-toothed creatures? These fleshy humans, I mean, all the meat is right on the outside, just here for the asking. How did we survive? We survived by working together. It's the only way it happened. And we've come to dominate the planet this way. Just like ants and bees dominate their ecological niche, humans dominate the planet because we work together. And the way we evolved to work together is our entire brain is formed. Our hormonal system is formed, and our nervous system is formed throughout the body to read each other, to respond to each other, to be able to cooperate, to survive. Hormones dedicated to being in relationship. Brain systems dedicated to being in relationship. And when we're not, if we're just standing out in the desert by ourselves, the same longings that made us seek out and cling to our tribe are operating. To be alone, to be cast out, is quite literally death. Literally death. For the infant, it's obviously death, but for the adult as well. How long would you survive alone? Just you. So, this really root nature of individuality, this sense of physiological separation, separation of mind, of consciousness, let's call it a fact, let's call it a truth. And intrinsic relationality, let's call it a truth. Let's recognize that the urgings, the longings, and the pains, the joys, the energies, the inspirations that come with other people are profoundly a part of this human experience. And so here we are, both. So I'd like to, with that perspective, the whole human perspective, investigate the Dhamma. And from my experience of immersing myself in the discourses of the Buddha and having this lens as I read and reread the suttas, it's become clear to me that the perspective that I'm sharing was not given the kind of language that I'm giving you now. There's hardly a word even for relationship in Pali. And yet, it's saturated into the teachings. So what I want to do now is tease that out. And there's a very specific hope or aspiration I have in doing this. And that is that doorways open to a sense of the path of insight, the path of liberation, the path of cessation of suffering and ignorance, that are even wider and more beautiful and more inspiring than what each of you have already touched. That maybe something can open further. Not something different, not something alien, not something outside, but something expanded in a sense of the totality of the lived path. That's my hope. So as a framework, let's start with the most basic teaching, the Four Noble Truths. So, to understand the first noble truth of suffering, it really helps to go back to this kind of moment of contact that we touched a little while ago, each contact with the world, and attune to your own sensitivity. And I mean that in every way. I mean the sensitivity of your skin. You know, have you ever fallen on asphalt or on sand and rock and scraped your skin and had some raw skin, like kind of, you know, red and outer layer of skin removed? You know, that sense of like, don't touch, because that's just the same nerve endings, but without the protection of the skin. That's how delicate this sense of touch is. The eyes, so sensitive to light, certain frequency of input. The ear is so sensitive. If you go into a room that's perfectly quiet and you discover it's not perfectly quiet, because you can hear your own bloodstream, you can hear your own nervous system and heart. So sensitive. Just the little tiny pressure changes. Tiny pressure changes. It's another, it's the world touching, right? It's the world touching. Just like the way it touches the eyes and touches the skin. The chemical sensitivity to taste and smell. Little molecule differences, little tiny differences playing across the tongue and the nose. And when a thought touches the mind, how sensitive is that? And so this sensitivity, here we are, this organism, like naked in the world. Even when we put on clothing, we're naked in the world. And every contact brings some kind of response, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and then the wanting and so on, that just comes out of being an animal. No moral judgments there, just the response of the organism. Well, from the individual standpoint, all these contacts and all these pleasant and unpleasant things and so on, we can see, oh, pretty easily that, you know, the craving for the pleasant and the, you know, all the kind of stuff that we all know that happens and drives us, oh yeah, I definitely want that hot fudge sundae or that, you know, sushi or whatever you have. So on the other hand, you know, we're constantly running away from what is unpleasant. Fine, that's just being an organism in this environment. But we begin to see that when the touch is the touch perceived as another human being, then not only do we have sort of this base of pleasant, unpleasant colors and so on, we actually recruit into that moment all of these mechanisms evolved over thousands, millions of years to be particularly responsive to human beings. So each contact is amplified by our own nervous systems, by our own evolution, by our hormonal systems, so that the wanting and the not wanting takes over the whole body. Do you know what I mean? I mean, this is not well, it kind of is rocket science, but it's not distant. This is just the lived experience of being human, right? So how could we possibly talk about suffering without understanding, really, this whole spectrum of being human. And so we ask in this, you know, impermanent world where we can't control the world, we can't make it the way we want, it's constantly changing. All that stuff you know. But it's not just that there's like cars and trees and weather and stuff. There's human beings that are constantly impermanent and uncontrollable. And oh my God, you know? We're talking about the interweaving of this incredibly brilliant brain each of us has, and putting multiple brilliant brains together in this, with this completely responsive body just vibrating totally, and we form these human systems that are stirring and re-stirring so much emotion, so much response. And in the case of, you know, trying to get some kind of stability and lasting happiness, you know, all that vibrating nature, it's just always going to be uneasy. It's just built in, built into the system. But what drives that, and here we come to the second noble truth of the arising of suffering, the origin of suffering, and the kind of the classic origin, the surging that keeps this system going, is the organism's constant thirst. Thirst, of course, for pleasure, yeah? Like, driven by pleasure, which is the same as being driven to avoid pain, right? Same thing. So here we are, orienting in the world to get whatever we can. And not only do we want the nice flavors and the beautiful things to look at, we want the pleasures of each other. And again, the whole body, the whole body-mind wants that. We want each other, and we fear each other. That's the other side. It's all the same, right? So we're constantly in this push-pull with each other. And this, too, is the craving, the hunger, the thirst that drives us forward through life. Why not just sit there? Why not? Because there's this wanting, the energy of wanting, deep, deep thirst. And we want to survive. We want to exist. We want to gobble the world because it keeps telling us, I exist, I am, I am. And in particular, what tells us I am more powerfully and more completely than any other sense input is another human being. You look at me and I am. The mother looks at the infant and the infant finds who she is. There's an empty hole that can never be filled if that doesn't happen. It's basic to a feeling of safety in the world. We're constantly seeking to sustain, to fill, to replenish, or to just try and kind of fill a hole. And that is also tanha, that is also thirst. Hunger. It drives us forward. But because we're so sensitive, we also are constantly trembling at the boundary of each experience because of these nerves and this sight and this delicate, complicated mind, this heart. And when the world is touching us, coming at us, and we're coming at the world, and we're in this stew, this cauldron, boiling cauldron of life, then that urge to get out, to not exist, to escape, is also a hunger that drives us forward. Let me find some way of not being devoured by that complex world. So these cravings drive us forward. And of course, this arising takes many other forms on top of that engine of craving. You know, each moment of greed or hatred, you know, of course, is part of that. All of the doubts and fears and the way our personality makes particulars out of these cravings, I mean, it's just limitless, right? Facebook, Twitter. War. The whole thing. So we say, okay, begin to get a sense of the whole human experience, and we say, well, what is the meaning of cessation? Cessation of suffering, cessation of the constant grabbing of the world, the momentum and the pushing forward that is kind of the friction that we call regular life. Is that as good as it gets? Is this, you know, constantly being buffeted by all this stuff, all this tenderness? So what is this cessation? What is this possibility of a human life, still fully human, fully sensitive, but not enslaved? The multiple layers by which we can look at this thing we call liberation or cessation, cessation of suffering, run from the cessation that comes as there's a gradual diminishing of the thrust of this hunger, of this craving that drives us, and a gradual diminishing of being driven in each moment by the jerkiness of our own greed, our own fear, our own anger. So just from the straight ahead standpoint of me and my personality and, you know, me at work and me with my friends and all that regular stuff, we can begin to taste the simple liberative process of not being as susceptible to every insult, every possible wish that will or won't be fulfilled, to our own inner push to become something special. All these things we can, I think all of us can see, understand, relate to, that's very tangible. Kind of a psychological healing that happens, the calming that happens, the perhaps being less driven, that can happen. And of course, one of the things that we see as the mind becomes more sensitive, alert, and refined in its own knowing itself, is that there's ever more subtle, you might say, or not as obvious layers of wanting and fear that we touch into. So it was a kind of a radical thing that the Buddha said in this third noble truth, in pointing not towards a lasting, say, sensual pleasure, pointing not towards even lasting emotional and relational satisfaction, but pointing towards peace, pointing towards equanimity, pointing towards contentment. Contentment. So simple, and yet it can seem so far away, and certainly so countercultural. Contentment. A ceasing of the fires that burn, not pouring something else on, however sweet it might be. Because the stimulation and the wanting that's inherent in whatever we've taken on and constructed, it's tenuous again. When there's contentment in the heart, when there's a recognition or a robustness of balance and equanimity, something strange happens. What looked to us when we were wrapped up in our culture of stimulation, this vibrating bag of nerves that we are and bag of conditioning and tendencies, when we look at that, the stability of contentment and equanimity and peace looks like nothing. It's like nothing. There's not this stuff happening. But the actual lived experience is that refinement of sensitivity of the mind and the body, when lifted of the burden of constantly re-stimulating, is actually blissful. It's actually a unspeakably positive experience. So we could talk about something like the cooling of nirvana, nibbana, and in trying to describe it in positive terms, like, oh, it just feels so great, or I'm happy all the time, or something like that, it just makes no sense. You see what I'm saying? That it just makes no sense, because we're still stuck in our own paradigm of getting or having an experience. But the value of going to these ultimates, to accepting the psychological benefits of Buddhist practice, of a Eightfold Path and so on, to accept those as beautiful and essential, but to be willing to touch cessation, relinquishment, equanimity, contentment, and understand that what looks like nothing from our culture of stimulation is actually the most profound happiness possible. and to be challenged by that. So here we come to this vision, and we say, okay, if I understand this human experience, the suffering, the urges that drive the suffering forward, and if I understand that there's this way of being in the world, in this very same world, and yet completely not being in this world in the way of dysfunction and pain, that there is something else possible, then we say, of course, what's the path? The Fourth Noble Truth, the Noble Eightfold Path. So I'd like to offer let's call it a bird's eye view. Bird's eye in the sense of, I'd like to move through it quickly enough that we have time to talk together about this stuff, not just me talking at you. I'm just sort of laying the framework for us to talk together about it. And if we continue from this whole person or whole human or full Dhamma perspective, then we want to understand both the sort of aspect of the path that is most commonly seen, I think, which is, you know, I am on the path, very individual kind of thing. So I practice right view and right intention and right speech and action and all that stuff. And how do I do it? And I'd like to suggest that we expand that. I'd like to suggest that even, as I said earlier, that the Buddha taught this expanded view, which is how do we live the path? As much as how do I live the path, not separating those, okay? And I'll start with right view. And as I start with right view, the best place to begin is that what we're doing right now is practicing right view, right? So this voice of another and wise attention are the two things necessary for the arising of right view, the Buddha said. So the voice of another and wise attention. So this is actually the path. You sitting in the chair now happens to be me talking. Pretty soon it'll be all of us. And the listening that's happening, giving attention, talking about the nature of the human experience in a way that recognizes suffering and freedom, this is a practice, and this is what the path feels like. Right? Could it not be path? Right path or wrong path, it's path of some sort. Right? But maybe this is right view. Maybe this is a good practice we're doing. See what I'm saying, though? It's not like the path is some abstract, weird, out there thing. This is the path. We're practicing right view. The voice of another and wise attention. It's relational. Now you see, the Buddha said, what are the two conditions arising necessary for the arising of right view? The voice of another and wise attention. He didn't say relationship or relationality. He just said this and this. And when we look at what are the, you know, the Buddha's teaching on sort of the qualities that are necessary for cultivating right view, the actual practice. So morality, it's a relational, you know, a wholesome relational way of being in the world that is kind and safe for others. Learning, discussion, tranquility, and insight. There's five conditions necessary for the arising of right view. So we got the morality piece. That's obviously a social relational piece. We'll get to more of that in a moment. Learning. How does learning happen? Well, certainly in the Buddha's time, when there were virtually no printed materials and certainly no recorded materials, it was human to human learning, and then you can study, but you chant together, you explore the teachings together, you receive the teachings from a teacher, you share the teachings with each other. That's learning. Learning is a process. It's a relational process. You gain perspectives from others that you don't have yourself. And discussion. Well, need I say more, right? And then tranquility is both individual and relational, of course. And as the mind becomes more still, you can see things as they are. So that conduces to that understanding we're calling right view, wise understanding, and insight. So we'll talk more about relational practice and insight in a moment. But individual practice and insight, we know from our traditional Vipassana meditation that when you learn to calm down and observe experience moment by moment, especially with frameworks of the Dhamma, the wise frameworks of the Dhamma, then insight is just waiting for you. And when the mind understands things more clearly, when there is the arising of right view, and you understand suffering, and you understand that, it can't always be fed, will always be the hunger will always lead to more suffering. So the cessation of hunger and the relinquishment and the contentment, and you understand that direction of liberation. You feel that. You know it. That's the wise view. Then naturally, the heart goes there. So that the right intention or the aiming of the mind is naturally flowing out of right view. So what are these right intentions? Well, it turns out that if we have this lens of both the individual and the relational, that we get a real clear sense of what the Buddha was teaching. The three classic right intentions, Sammasankappa, were the intention of renunciation, relinquishment, the intention of non-harming and non-hatred, non-anger, right? And the wholesome equivalent of compassion and loving kindness. So the point here is that we have this basic aiming of the mind towards letting go that has such a, you know, it, we can be taught so deeply about this in our silent individual practice when we see how the mind clings, and moment by moment we feel the grip of that clinging and we learn to let go. We learn to calm down. We learn the joy of release. This renunciation becomes a natural leaning of the heart. But the other two right intentions, classic right intentions, are both in relationship to other people. The non-harming, non-cruelty, non-hatred, the loving kindness and compassion. And so there's a very direct teaching that if you want to head towards liberation, then the mind is aiming towards compassion. The mind is aiming towards loving kindness. That's the path. It's not like something extra. It's the real deal. And if we understand this relational nature of the human heart, we see why. Because the mind that is wrapped in cruelty and hatred is forever tense and tight and self-absorbed. It's built in. It's a structural thing. So as long as that's the orientation of the heart, you're stuck in suffering for sure. There's no other possibility. The math doesn't work out. See what I'm saying? It's just very straightforward. But we want to experience our path, the whole of our path, knowing that framework from the beginning. It's not like, oh, I'm a good Buddhist meditator and I'm going to be liberated, and so sometimes on Sunday I practice loving kindness or something. It's a whole life oriented towards, you know, loving kindness or hatred and aversion and pushing away. A life that's oriented towards the tenderness of the heart that is touched and moved to kindness, moved to care as a way of living, not some behavioral fix. It comes from the intrinsic right view, the understanding of our relational nature, of our sensitivity and the sensitivity of others. So that brings us to the morality aspect of the path. And I'd like to frame this again in a shorthand and say that right speech, right action, and right livelihood can be understood as the blossoming of these intentions in this good direction, right, into action. How do we act? How do we live? So all three of these can be summed up as right action. But there's two areas of action that have special power. One is the action of speech. And this is growing from the power of this mind to contact another human being, mind to mind, like we're doing now. This is the power of speech, that you can have some sense of what's in my mind in this moment is amazing. And that we do that with each other all the time. We're constantly, constantly exchanging mental direction. Now, we can do this in such a way that inclines towards wisdom, understanding. We can do what we're doing now of exploring the human experience, the Dhamma, as a lived experience. Or we can, you know, get involved in really, you know, hateful, painful things with each other, and politically and socially, and we can be very abusive to each other. Why is verbal abuse so painful? Because you are being hit. Your mind is being hit by my mind. When I say something cruel, when I lie to you, when I speak ill of you to others, it's an act of violence. It's a particularly strong act. So like traditional right action, no killing, right? No stealing. Well, verbally, it's right there. The killing and stealing. So another category of right action that is given special place, pride of place, if you will, its own path factor, is right livelihood or right living. Why? Well, if I could put it this way, the Buddha was no fool. He well understood, just by looking around, that in order to survive, human beings work all the time to survive. you know, we're barely scraping by on this planet. And when you don't scrape by, you starve to death. So what are you spending most of your time doing? Call it livelihood. So what you do and how you do it is an immensely powerful force in sculpting the heart. And if the way you live and the way you use resources is coming from that standpoint of abusiveness, of cruelty, of hatred, of selfishness, then once again, you're conditioning the mind towards tension and fear and grasping, and this whole quality of relinquishment, equanimity, contentment, and the peace and the bliss that comes with it. Not possible, just not possible. And on the other hand, when your livelihood is involved with and conditioned by kindness, compassion, and a sense of relinquishment, what great goodness comes of that? Tremendous. You know, and professions, the professions per se, you know, you examine in your own heart how you live. But the point here is that this relational aspect, right speech is relational, right livelihood is relational, right action is relational, social, that you examine in your own mind, your own heart, what is the direction, what is the sankhapa, the intention, the aiming of the mind. Because it's enormously important. So we come to right effort, right mindfulness, and right calm concentration. And I want to give some special time to mindfulness and concentration as relational practices, because otherwise the path, I think, lacks some of its potential. But to start with right effort, like right view, the Buddha named right effort and right mindfulness as kind of essential components that infuse all of the other path factors. Why right view? Because you know right from wrong speech, right from wrong intention, you know, this kind of thing, and the aiming of the mind. So if there's not right view, there will not be, for example, right livelihood or right concentration or something. Right mindfulness, I'm going to come to effort next because that's what I'm focused on right now. Right mindfulness, unless there's enough mindfulness to remain with the wholesome path, then you'll wander all over the place. So mindfulness is necessary. But why right effort? Why does that have that importance of right view and right mindfulness? Because otherwise you'll just be functioning on habit. You have to have the energy. The strength of intention has to have the energy behind it. So right effort is summarized, I summarize it rather, as out with the bad, in with the good. So you've got the prevention and the abandoning of unwholesome. I'm giving you a classical thing here. And you've got the cultivation and then the maintenance and increase of the wholesome. So out with the bad, in with the good. And what that means is just moment by moment, what's good, what's harmful. And that takes effort. Takes commitment. It's not a path for just kind of lackadaisical engagement. It's a real path. It's a real path. But also, if you think about abandoning the unwholesome, Think of all the things that you already do to abandon the unwholesome, you know, and cultivate the wholesome. Obviously, if you're here, you probably meditate. It's cultivating the wholesome, cultivating loving kindness and mindfulness and concentration and energy and so on. When you go to a psychotherapist, you're abandoning the unwholesome, right? And cultivating the wholesome. You're abandoning old patterns that don't work so well. So a relational practice of right effort, where you engage with others, or if you're engaging, let's say, in work for social justice or to be involved in environmental justice, you're abandoning your own unwholesome habits and tendencies and cultivating these wholesome tendencies actively, intentionally. And, you know, there are times on the path, like when you do intensive retreat, where that sense of right effort needs the balance of not too much push of attention, based intention. On the other hand, there's no kidding about it. The Buddha was really clear. Right effort also involves sometimes really strong effort, straight ahead, you know, energy, strong application, not pussyfooting around the path, but landing on it. And sometimes in our kind of pressured, accomplishment-oriented culture, we overcompensate in right effort, don't push too hard. Watch out, because this other part of right effort, to really give yourself over to the path, is also been a really valuable thing for a lot of people. But I want to go to mindfulness and concentration specifically in closing, because then we're through with the whole path factor and we can explore together. Mindfulness is this remembering, right? This remembering the moment, remembering whatever framework for investigating experience. If you're remembering the breath, mindful of the breath. If you're remembering to attend to impermanence. If you're simply remembering to notice the mind itself as it thinks, as it lets go of thought, to notice the mind states. Just remembering, they're not far away. It's not hard to notice that the breath is happening. But we just forget to notice, right? It's not that big a deal, but it is, because the mind goes off. So, usually, our individual meditation practice has this great benefit of simplicity, leaving out the complications of other people. But alas, we find that we have the complications of our own minds. When we meditate with other people and practice mindfulness together, we have the complication of other people and our response to other people in meditation. But what we also have is the power of mutual reminding, where, you know, simply by sitting with another person, with the agreement, let's remember to be awake, let's watch the mind together, let's explore the fact, the living fact of impermanence right now, right? Whereas my mind alone might wander all over the place, if I'm with you and pausing and noticing this impermanence and saying something about it, then that brings your mind to it. And then you speak, and it brings my mind to it. And together, we're drawing in closer and closer to this felt sense of change. And the mindfulness of change can get very refined and bright as we stay there together. And so this, again, it's like, remember we talked about recruiting this relational circuitry and relational nature into dysfunction, which is what we often do. The wanting and the urging and the anger and the fear. This is recruiting those same sensitivities and tendencies in service of sati and samadhi, of mindfulness and concentration. So just this very responsive heart brings us into the moment. You know, if I just say to you, for example, as I am saying to you in all sincerity, you know, how's your mindfulness right now? Check it out. You know, you might be inspired to look at your own mind, to notice if you're paying attention to the body mind, if you're lost in some kind of spinning, right? To feel the body. Well, this is a relational practice of mindfulness that we just did, just this moment. My reminding you. Now, if we're together as peers, not teacher thing, and exploring together the experience of mindfulness, how refined might this become, this sense of the present moment, when it rides on the strength of our relational nature. And what might it reveal about the heart, about the mind, as it's functioning relationally? Not just thinking about relationship, which of course you do when you sit in silence, but now it's like, what's the lived reality of this moment? And in this shared inquiry, the quality of samadhi, samatha, of calm concentration, can become very strong. Because we, if you will, rivet each other to the moment. As we investigate this moment of experience together. Unto the cessation of language, even. So, combining our sense of individual practice of mindfulness and concentration with a relational practice of mindfulness and concentration opens up a wholeness about the path that addresses this both individual and relational nature of the human experience. And that's what I mean by Dhamma, the wholeness of Dhamma. And all of this is leading in this direction of relinquishment, contentment, cessation, so I think I'll stop there and see if there's, you know, just open the space to see if there's any observations or questions. And I would just suggest that as you prepare to speak, and I hope you do, I hope we can engage together. kind of, if you can rest in this reflection of this relational practice here, so that the questions of what is this living experience of a whole Dhamma, what's it like? And you might even ask yourself, what is the nature of Sangha, of community, when this sense of relationality infuses the totality of the Eightfold Path?
Saying is being mindful of relationship. Often it's, I don't bring mindfulness to my relationship, I bring a habit to my relationship. So to be put, and it's much safer and easier to meditate on my own and notice my relationship, say, with myself. But when I'm put in with another human being, it all comes up, all my vulnerability and the things that I could kind of manage, you know, through things I built up, defenses, they just all are right there. And now I'm being mindful of that. And I know, I can see through what you're saying as far as how the Eightfold Path and the suffering really comes up.
Yeah.
But it's been helpful to keep going with it.
Yeah. So just to repeat for those who may or may not have heard, the sense of when you meditate with another, it would seem that you come face to face with the suffering and struggle of being in relationship, and that can be pretty challenging. It's really true. But I would ask also for us to remember, what kind of struggle do we experience in our silent individual meditation? Right? The mind is running all over the place. And it kind of suffers about its suffering. It's like, oh my God, look at my mind, this is really terrible. And it's got another layer of suffering as you meditate, you know? It's like, oh God, give me a break, you know? And in relationship, yeah, you know, because you're sitting with someone and you see, even though the contract is let's meditate together, let's contemplate, let's say, aging, illness and death, or let's contemplate gratitude. And that might be the kind of, with pausing and mindfulness and all that, that might be the whole assignment, right? That's all you're doing. And all of a sudden you realize, wow, I want to impress this person. I want them to like me. What did they just say? They don't like me. They're judging me. It's like, oh my God. So it's the equivalent of the wandering mind creating more of its own suffering. But now, as you were saying, you see it. It's like right there. It's like, what is this about? It's that thirst. It's that craving. I want to be. I want to exist. I want the pleasure of being liked. I want the feeling of existence to be stabilized. Or I want to get out because it's so scary and so tender. It's all right there. Yeah.
I enjoyed my work as a music teacher, and I find it useful to use metaphors to convey things that are new or unknown.
Yeah.
And I find in situations to be very perplexing.
To convey what?
To convey the inner work.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Wow, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, what a great question. He's suggesting, is there any kind of metaphor that could be used to convey the nature of the inner work that we're talking about? Is that a good summary? Yeah. Yeah, I'll give you a few. Yeah. The first is it's as if we're carrying, each of us, a very heavy stone. And everywhere we go, there's a sense of feeling the burden is making us tired, and it's life is a struggle. And the stone is the stone of everything I want to get and be. You know, all the things that I want to have happen. And this stone is so heavy, and yet we can't put it down because that's my job, that's my life. You know, it's like no escape. And yet, as simple as it can be to actually put down a physical stone, if we can get past the habit mind that has to carry that stone, we can just set it down. So the sense of lightness, the sense of freedom and release comes from the absence of something. And so there's this sense of the path as a path of relinquishment, of letting go. And the sense of lightness and freedom that results is just this very natural turning. So that's one. And another one is, I'm going to use this metaphor or simile both ways. And really is a metaphor because we take it almost as truth of a stream. Okay? So, let's start with a raging torrent that's come about from a flood. It's been raining and storming for days and days. Global warming is finally taking its full toll on the human species, and the waters are rushing. And like the tsunami in Sri Lanka, or the tsunami that was in Fukushima, Japan, it's coming forward, and it is horror and terror and pain. And we are carried along by that stream, and life continues to be an inescapable struggle. And going with the stream, in this case, is to just perpetuate the suffering. Okay? So now let's use the stream metaphor the other way. In the sense of, you might say, almost a Taoist, going with the flow, going with the stream. And talk about it in Buddhist teachings, you have this thing called stream entry. And it's where you get enough understanding, something clicks in your understanding deeply enough that you no longer have to try and figure out the direction. You feel the direction of the stream and you let go into the stream. And there's a kind of a surrender to the flow, a surrender to the emergence, where in this case, to go against the stream would be to go with anger and hatred. It hurts. It no longer feels good to be revengeful or angry. It no longer feels good to be greedy, which in the past you thought it did. So there's a releasing into a stream, a going with the stream, and the stream is going towards kindness, towards care, towards generosity, towards wholesome concern for others, and kindness to yourself. It's kind of a allowing, and that it can be actually also a stream of inquiry. Life becomes an inquiry. You release into that sense of inquiry, and there's almost a magic in life, like a positive magic, not magic like woo-woo-woo, but a sense of luminosity of life that you're letting go into. That's a kind of a stream entry. So there's another one. And there's also there's a picture coming up from the discourses where the Buddha talks about a strong man pressing and crushing the head of a weak man. It's kind of gross, but it's like, you know, or there's another one with as if you had a strap around your head that was too tight. And it's like, you know, for a long, 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 long time, terrible headache. And the letting go of the strap is a kind of this quality of release, of letting go. And so you could look at your life and say, where are the leather straps on my head? You know? And the sense of freedom, the sense of being on the other side, is likened to being, for example, out of debt, to being free of disease, to be having crossed over a dangerous desert and being on the other side safe. Right? So there's each of these has this sense of release, rather than getting some like magic castle with a golden dragon that lays golden geese that lay golden eggs or something. You know, it's rather than this getting and accumulating, which you then have to protect, right, and hold on to, is this kind of sense of relief. Do any of those touch home? Thank you for the lovely question. Yeah. There's maybe time for one more. Oh, very good. Yeah.
Thank you. You wished for us that we would find something that would move us along the path, and I wanted to express that the relational part that really awoke for me was when you were speaking about use of words. And, you know, intellectually I know this, you know, the selfing part. But then I was reflecting on a prayer I say every day with me and I. And just the opening up to say we, and moving from, you know, the self to relationship. Mm. So simple, you know, all words we use, but
yeah.
It's really profound, because what I heard you saying is that it will create a shift, it can shift, and therefore the, you know, the habit, the culture, the conditioning that from evolution to now, we change that, it manifests to something else,
yeah.
And the other part is gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Obviously, you were ready for that. I mean, you know, you had all the conditioning ready for the... Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Sympathetic joy arises. So now's a good time to stop, by the clock anyway. And So as we close, I'd like to close with a living sense of what we've been talking about, that even the we of this group we are living in the matrix of our whole society, our culture, the whole world. And so I'd like to close by reflecting on that, remembering that together. You know, for example, here we have this incredible privilege, the wealth of this space and heat and food and safety. And how fortunate we are, and to also remember and to let our hearts vibrate with the fact that there are so many that don't have this safety, that don't have enough to eat, that are suffering terribly, just as we suffer here, and also just the bare survival. And even those who do have enough but are so lost in anger and fear, so lost in greed and confusion, the tremendous pain, even of people in power. And to dedicate whatever good comes from our being together to the benefit of all. May all beings, without exception, be free from suffering. May all beings, without exception, be well and happy. May all beings be at peace. We share the merits of this practice with everyone. Outward and unbounded. May all beings be free. May there be peace. May there be peace. May there be peace.